and everything Serafin was like that. A circumstantial case for bribery, based on the coincidence of a politician benefiting at the same time Curtis had some luck with a law or a lawsuit. But the harassment campaign against her was real. The hacker who fucked up her blog for a month was real, and the three guys who threatened to rape and kill her were real. And now she's dead. And I'm 99% sure it wasn't some meth head who broke into her house and used a silenced weapon to put two bullets into her heart. But Curtis may not have been the one responsible, Westerberg said. You said she named a lot of people in her blog. Maybe one of them was the person who killed her. Yeah, maybe, DeMarco said. What have the Bismarck cops got on her murder? I have no idea, DeMarco said. They consider me a suspect because I admitted I was probably the last person who saw her alive, other than her killer, and I'm the one who found the body. They don't seriously think I killed her, but they're not talking to me about their investigation. Do you understand that Ms. Johnson's murder is a local police matter, and that the FBI has no jurisdiction? Yeah, and I don't care. And neither does John Mahoney. Westerberg shook her head. So what do you expect me to do, DeMarco? Start by reading Sarah's blog. That's going to give you a migraine, but it will tell you everything she suspected about Curtis. Lean on the Bismarck cops to make sure they're doing everything they can. Take a look at Curtis's phone calls and emails, and that would require a warrant. That's your problem, DeMarco said. I'm just saying do whatever you have to do to find who killed her. Okay, Westerberg said. But DeMarco got the impression that her definition of do whatever you have to do wasn't the same as his. Anything else? She asked. No. DeMarco thought about telling her about the trip he was making to Great Falls tomorrow, but he didn't want to give Westerberg the chance to tell him he shouldn't go. All right, she said. I'll give you a call in a few days and let you know what I found. She handed him a card and said, if anything else occurs to you, call me at that number. But don't call and ask for progress reports. When I know something, I'll let you know. DeMarco could see that her attitude needed a slight adjustment. What's your first name? He asked. Agent, she said. Tough cookie. Okay, agent. Let me explain something to you. Right now, as far as John Mahoney is concerned, you are the Federal Bureau of Investigation when it comes to Sarah Johnson. But Mahoney isn't going to talk to you. He's going to talk to your boss's boss's boss. In other words, Mahoney, who was a good friend of the President of the United States, is going to call the director of the FBI and tell him that he, meaning me, isn't satisfied with your performance in solving the murder of the granddaughter of a man who saved his life in Vietnam. Are you threatening me, DeMarco? Well, yeah. I thought I was being pretty clear about that. I'm threatening to destroy your career if I don't get the sense that you're busting your ass on this case. I liked Sarah, and I admired what she was trying to do, and I think it may have been my fault she was killed. So this is personal for me, and I'm making sure you understand that it's personal for you, too. DeMarco stood up. I'll be calling you, agent. Now what's going on? Marjorie said. When Heckler called, she had been trying to get a grass stain out of a pair of Bobby's jeans that had cost $70. She was going to wring her son's neck if he didn't change out of his good clothes when he got home from school. I don't know, Heckler said. About an hour ago, he met with a tough-looking old guy and had a drink with him. I ran the plates on the guy's truck, and he's from Montana, and his name is Doug Thorpe. Thorpe is a fly-fishing guide. I have no idea why he was talking to DeMarco, but based on the way they both looked, they weren't talking about fly-fishing. I'm trying to get more info on Thorpe, and when I do, I'll let you know. Then, after he met with Thorpe, he met with a tough-looking gal in the Pierogue Grill. Marjorie rolled her eyes. Everybody DeMarco met with, according to Heckler, was tough-looking, like DeMarco was the leader of some kind of street gang. So he met a woman in a bar, Marjorie said. Maybe he was trying to get laid again, like he did with the teacher. I don't think so, Heckler said. I couldn't hear what they were saying to each other, but judging by the body language, it wasn't a friendly conversation. I think she could be a cop. Why would you think that? Marjorie said. Because when DeMarco first sat down with her, I caught a glimpse of a gun she's packing in a shoulder holster. So I think she could be a cop, but I don't know for sure. DeMarco left the bar before she did, and I followed him, but I'll go back to the bar later and see if I can find out who she is. Chapter 15. Marjorie hadn't seen Bill all day yesterday, the day they discovered Johnson's body. She was concerned that he was off on a bender, but when she called him, he told her he was in Belcourt. He'd driven up there to talk to Buchanan, the state senator who needed his septic system fixed and a contractor who could fudge the necessary permits. Marjorie had forgotten about Buchanan with all the stuff going on with Sarah Johnson. Bill finally dragged himself into the office at 10:30, unshaven, bloodshot eyes, obviously hungover. "How to go with Buchanan?" she asked. "Okay, I think." "You think?" "It went okay. He's our new best friend." Bill dropped down in his chair, but then just sat there, looking like he didn't know what to do next, and Marjorie snapped. "Hey, you have to get back on track. You need to knock off the boozing and the moping and get refocused. Johnson's out of our hair, and Curtis will be happy about that, but..." "Out of our hair, Marge? She's dead. I don't want to hear it. Did you send Murdoch the rest of his money?" "Hell yes. You think I want him coming up here to collect?" "Then we're done with that whole thing. Now get to work." Men were just useless. Which reminded her, she needed to call Dick and tell him to get a guy over to do the annual maintenance on the air conditioner before it got hot. She went outside to have a smoke and call her husband, but Heckler called her before she could. "DeMarco just took off in an airplane," Heckler said. "Thank God," Marjorie said. "No, you don't understand. I followed him to the Bismarck airport, but he didn't catch a commercial flight. He caught a charter flight. Naturally, I couldn't follow the guy after the plane took off. It cost me $50, which I plan to expense to you, to find out where the plane's going. It's headed to Great Falls." "Great Falls, Montana, or Great Falls, Virginia?" Marjorie knew, the way her luck had been going, that that was a really dumb question. "Montana," Heckler said. "DeMarco left his rental car in the parking lot here at the airport, so I'm guessing he's coming back. The only thing I can do at this point is wait for him to return." To DeMarco's relief, the plane landed on its wheels, on a runway, instead of upside down in a wheat field. Small planes made him nervous. That morning, he'd woken up early and driven to the Bismarck airport, where he discovered that the woman with the deep voice who'd booked the charter flight for him was also his pilot. She had dark hair streaked with a lot of gray, wore no makeup, and looked harder than granite. He handed her his government credit card and signed a bunch of papers without reading them or looking at the amount she charged to his card. He imagined the papers were an insurance waiver that said if she crashed the plane and killed him, his estate couldn't sue her company. He didn't care. They flew from Bismarck to Great Falls in some kind of small jet. DeMarco didn't pay any attention to the type of plane it was. The only thing he did was buckle his seatbelt and say a silent prayer that the lady knew how to fly. She asked him if he wanted her to point out the sights as they were flying, and he said, "Sure." "Well, that's North Dakota down there," she said, and then didn't say anything else until they crossed into Montana. He took a taxi from the Great Falls airport to Janet Tyler's house. Tyler was the lawyer who had dropped a water contamination lawsuit against Curtis to get her son out from under various robbery and assault charges. Sarah had told DeMarco that Tyler expressed remorse for what she'd done, but refused to tell Sarah exactly what had happened or how Curtis had gotten to her. DeMarco's plan was to hit Tyler right between the eyes with Sarah's death. When Tyler answered the door, DeMarco held up his congressional ID like it was a badge and said, "Miss Tyler, I'm from the United States Congress. My name's DeMarco." "Congress?" "Yeah. Sarah Johnson's dead. You know, the young lady who came to see you a couple of days ago? Someone shot her twice in the heart." "Oh my God," Tyler said, holding her hands to her mouth, her eyes going wide with shock. "May I come in?" Tyler was so thin that DeMarco thought she might be anorexic. Sarah had said the woman was in her 50s, but she appeared to be at least a decade older. There were dark half circles under her eyes from lack of sleep, and because her face was so pale, it looked as if the skin under her eyes had been smudged with charcoal. Her hair was blonde and brittle, like dried-out straw. She backed into the living room and pointed DeMarco to an overstuffed chair. The blinds in the room were closed, but enough light entered through the slats that they could see each other. He wondered why she didn't let in the sunlight. He wondered if she ever ventured out into the sunlight. There were at least a dozen photographs of a handsome young man in the room. The young man had Tyler's eyes. Like I said, Sarah Johnson's dead. And I think the reason she's dead is because she came to see you. And even though you didn't tell her anything, whoever killed her didn't want her asking more questions. That was a lie, and not fair to Tyler, but DeMarco didn't care. But now I want the answer to the question she asked you, and you're going to tell me. When you dropped that lawsuit to keep your son from going to jail, who got to you? Who was the person who talked to you? Tyler started shaking her head. DeMarco shouted, "Don't you give a shit that someone killed that girl?" "Yes, of course, but let me explain something to you, Janet. The FBI is investigating Sarah's death. The Bureau was also looking into the claims she made in her blog about Curtis bribing and blackmailing people to get his way. In other words, you're going to be investigated. But the thing is, I don't care about you, and I can make the FBI back off if you cooperate." Now Tyler was weeping softly, but DeMarco didn't know if she was weeping for herself or Sarah. Speaking more softly, DeMarco said, "Janet, I know you're a decent person. I know all you were doing was trying to save your son, and I have no desire to see you disbarred. I just want to find the person responsible for killing Sarah. If you give me what I want, you'll never see me again, and the FBI won't come after you."
"Do you have children, Mr. DeMarco?"
"No."
"Then you can't possibly understand. The chances of me winning that suit against Curtis were small to begin with, and even if I'd won, his lawyers would have appealed. But my son was going to go to jail, and he didn't deserve to be in jail. He was sick. He wasn't a criminal. The damn laws in this country about drugs. Paul would have died in jail. The only time he was strong was when he was high. He would have committed suicide."
"I understand," DeMarco said. He didn't know what else to say.
"Then my son died anyway. After I turned my back on the people who hired me to sue Curtis, Paul relapsed again and killed himself behind the wheel of a car."
"I'm sorry," DeMarco said, "but Sarah..."
"Bill Logan," she said. "Well, that's what he said his name was. He was the one who came to see me and told me that if I dropped the suit, he could guarantee my son wouldn't serve time."
"Finally. What else do you know about Logan? What does he look like?"
"He was about your age. A tall, nice-looking man with dark hair. He was very polite, not threatening at all."
"Do you know where he lives or where he works? Did he give you a card or a phone number?"
"No. All I know is his name. I'll never forget it because my life ended the day I talked to him."
When she said this, DeMarco had the impression that she was being literal.
Her life really did end after she betrayed her clients and her son died.
That she was still breathing was almost accidental.
"You said I could be disbarred. Well, I don't practice law anymore. After Paul died, I hardly ever leave this house. The only reason I'm cooperating with you is because I feel terrible about that young woman, but I don't care what happens to me."
As DeMarco was leaving her dark house, he wondered what the odds were that Janet Tyler would eventually commit suicide. He figured the odds were high. When he reached his car, he called Westerberg. It was nice having the Federal Bureau of Investigation at his beck and call. "Agent," he said when she answered, "I got a name, Bill Logan. I need to find out who he is and if he has any connection to Leonard Curtis."
"That's all you got? Bill Logan? No address, no DOB, nothing else?"
"Just the name.
What you could do is..." "Don't tell me how to do my job, DeMarco."
"Fine. Just get me some answers, and I need them quick. I've got a plane at my disposal, and I'll be back at the airfield in half an hour, and I want to tell my pilot where to go next." DeMarco liked saying, "my pilot." DeMarco arrived at the airfield to find his pilot reading a magazine with a picture of a horse on the cover. "I want to wait here for a while before flying back," he told her. "I'm waiting for a phone call." The pilot shrugged.
"It's your money," she said.
He noticed the magazine she was reading was called American Quarter Horse. He thought a quarter horse was the kind cowboys used to cut cattle out of the herd, to brand them or something, but wasn't sure. DeMarco had only been on a horse twice in his life, and both times he'd felt like the horse was the one in control. Yanking on the reins of a beast that weighed 1,000 pounds and had big teeth had never made sense to him.
"You own quarter horses?"
he asked the pilot.
Yeah, I've got two. I like them better than my husband and my kids. In fact, I'm thinking about selling one of my kids so I can buy another one. Half an hour later, as DeMarco was still learning why quarter horses were better than thoroughbreds, big-footed Clydesdales, and every other four-legged critter on the planet, his phone rang. It was Westerberg. "There's a Leslie William Logan in Bismarck," she said.
"Leslie?"
DeMarco said. "Yeah. He's self-employed and the co-owner of D&L Consulting. His partner is a woman named Marjorie Dawkins. Logan and Dawkins are also registered lobbyists in the state of North Dakota. But if you look at D&L Consulting's website, you can't figure out what the hell they do. It says they work on creating partnerships committed to integrity, whatever that means, and developing uncommon approaches to solving problems. Their website says they've worked with trade associations and numerous small businesses, but doesn't name a single business they've worked with. I mean, you couldn't get any more vague if you tried, and the address for the company is a post office box.
Are you saying you couldn't find a connection between this Leslie Logan and Leonard Curtis?
No, I'm not saying that, Westerberg said, because in addition to looking at D&L Consulting's website, I called a guy at the IRS and asked him to take a peek at the company's last tax return. 100% of D&L's business income, based on the 1099s in their return, comes from companies owned by Leonard Curtis.
This is good, agent. In fact, this is great. Give me Logan's home address,
DeMarco said. No, not until you tell me why you're asking about him.
I gotta think about that, DeMarco said.
What? Let me tell you something, DeMarco. You don't have a badge. You're not in law enforcement. I don't know what you do for John Mahoney, but you are not licensed or sanctioned to investigate people for murder or any other crime.
Yeah, I know. Which is why I gotta think about this whole thing.
If DeMarco hadn't disconnected the call, he would have heard Agent Westerberg curse in a most un-agent-like fashion. DeMarco told his horse-loving pilot that they could head back to Bismarck. He was genuinely relieved that that's where Logan lived. He didn't have any desire to see more of Montana or North Dakota. DeMarco hadn't told Westerberg that he suspected Bill Logan was Leonard Curtis's fixer because he wasn't sure that he wanted the FBI involved in whatever he was going to do next. And he didn't know what he was going to do next. The problem with Westerberg was that while she might attempt to build a legal case against Logan and Curtis and maybe Logan's partner, this lady Marjorie Dawkins, she would follow the law. This meant that she would worry about due process and warrants and people's right to counsel. And DeMarco didn't care about any of those things. DeMarco's objective was to make someone pay for Sarah's death, and he wasn't going to allow the niceties of the legal system to hinder him. DeMarco frankly doubted that Logan could be convicted of bribery, at least not based on what he knew so far or based on anything that Sarah had been able to find. Like in the case of Janet Tyler, Logan had most likely convinced a prosecutor to go easy on Tyler's son in exchange for helping the prosecutor's political career. However, there would be no hard evidence that Logan had bribed the prosecutor, and the prosecutor would maintain that he had the lawful authority to reach a plea bargain with Tyler's son that didn't include jail time. So if DeMarco was going to put Curtis or Logan in jail, he needed something more than he currently had. DeMarco also figured that Logan or Curtis didn't kill Sarah themselves, assuming they had anything at all to do with her death. Curtis certainly wouldn't have been directly involved in a murder. He was an executive who used his minions to do things for him. And although it was possible that Logan had killed her, it seemed more likely that Curtis or Logan would have hired a pro, a guy able to make an assassination look like a robbery gone bad. But if the FBI and the Bismarck cops couldn't identify the hitman, it seemed pretty unlikely that DeMarco would be able to do so. The hitman was a ghost. So DeMarco needed to figure out what he was going to do next and how best to use Westerberg. Agent Westerberg wouldn't appreciate this, but as far as DeMarco was concerned, she was a tool. And DeMarco hadn't decided if she was a sledgehammer he could use to pound on someone, or a scalpel he could use with precision to remove a malignant political cancer. Westerberg had peevishly refused to give him Logan's address, but DeMarco figured he now knew enough to find the guy. After landing back in Bismarck, he returned to his motel, powered up his trusty laptop, and went online. He entered the names William Logan, Leslie William Logan, and Bill Logan into one of those internet people search engines, and to his delight, found only three men in the city of Bismarck named Bill or William Logan. One of the Bill Logans was too old. He was 68, and Janet Tyler had said that the Logan DeMarco wanted was about his age. The second Logan was a general contractor. He had a website, an ad in the Yellow Pages, and was esteemed by the Better Business Bureau. The Bill Logan, who had convinced a prosecutor to go easy on Tyler's son, wasn't a carpenter, which led to the Logan he wanted, the third Bill Logan, and his home address was listed in the white pages of the Bismarck phone directory. DeMarco started to shut down his laptop, but then decided to check out the website Westerberg had found for DNL Consulting. And it was just like Westerberg had said. The website was a masterpiece of obfuscation. Logan and Dawkins claimed to be experienced political consultants, but they went out of their way to be as ambiguous as they could possibly be regarding what they actually did and who they represented. Since Logan was a registered lobbyist, however, Sarah should have been able to find a connection between Logan and Curtis. And the fact that she didn't, and considering how many hours Sarah had spent researching Curtis, could only mean that Logan and his partner made sure that there was no paper or internet trail tying them to their master. Logan and Dawkins were people who deliberately operated in the shadows, which is what lobbyists often did so the public wouldn't be able to see how they were twisting the political process. The one thing Logan and Dawkins had not been able to do was hide their fiscal connection to Curtis, but Sarah, unlike Agent Westerberg of the FBI, couldn't call up a pal at the IRS and ask about DNL Consulting's tax returns. DeMarco couldn't help but wonder if the night Sarah had called him, the last time he'd spoken to her, if she'd been about to tell him about DNL Consulting. Now he'd never know. DeMarco turned off his laptop and drove to see Leslie William Logan's house. It was made of brick, had a fancy front door, cedar shakes for a roof, a couple of chimneys, and a three-car garage. The landscaping was elaborate and looked like it was maintained by professionals. DeMarco figured the place had to be at least 4,000 square feet, and had it been located in D.C., it would have sold for well over $1 million, maybe two, which made him wonder how much money Bill Logan made. But DeMarco didn't stop. He returned to his motel for a good night's sleep. He wanted to be bright-eyed and alert when he began his campaign to destroy Bill Logan. By the time he was done, Logan's next home might be a cage. Chapter 16. The next morning, DeMarco forced himself out of bed at 6 a.m. Feeling like the walking dead, he headed in the direction of Logan's place. On the way, he stopped at a convenience store, bought coffee and donuts for breakfast, a couple cans of Coke, and two nasty-looking sandwiches that looked like they'd been sitting in the cooler since Sandwich invented the sandwich. There was nothing DeMarco hated more than surveillance duty, although he'd been required to perform this task a number of times while working for Mahoney. DeMarco didn't have a plan, not at this point. His only objective today was to see Logan in person, find out where he worked, and maybe follow him to see whom he met with and what he did during his workday. After that, he wasn't sure what he was going to do. Break into Logan's office and examine his files? See if he could find something that Westerberg could use as justification to get a warrant to tap his phones? He didn't know. But he had to start somewhere.
"You're not going to believe this," Heckler said. "Right now, DeMarco is parked outside your partner's house. He's watching the house."
"Son of a bitch," Marjorie muttered.
"Yeah. Yesterday, when he got back from Great Falls, he went to his motel, spent about an hour there. Then he got in his car and drove around for a while, and I couldn't figure out what he was doing. When he drove by Logan's place, I didn't think anything of it because he didn't stop. But then this morning, he gets up early and heads over here, and now he's just watching the house."
"Son of a bitch," Marjorie said again.
At 9 a.m., DeMarco's patience was rewarded when Logan's garage door rolled up and a red Porsche Boxster backed out. It was a nice-looking set of wheels, certainly much nicer than DeMarco's Toyota, but DeMarco couldn't clearly see the man who was driving. For all he knew, Logan could be gay and the driver could be his partner. Nonetheless, He followed the Porsche, and a few minutes later it pulled into the parking lot of a restaurant. A tall, good-looking, dark-haired guy about DeMarco's age stepped from the car. Based on the description Janet Tyler had given him, he was now fairly certain he was following Logan. DeMarco sat in his car and enviously watched through the windows of the restaurant as Logan ate breakfast. The waitress, who looked like she was about 19, stopped at his table 3 or 4 times, and DeMarco could tell by the way she was laughing and touching him on the shoulder that she was flirting with him. So much for Logan being gay. After an hour, Logan left the restaurant, and DeMarco followed him to a small strip mall. There was a Subway shop, a Hair Masters, and a FedEx Kinko's in the mall. The fourth storefront had a sign near the door too small for DeMarco to read from where he was parked, and the fifth office wasn't identified in any way. It had a dark green door with a mail slot and a single large picture window, but the blinds were closed, so he couldn't see inside. Logan parked next to a black Jeep Cherokee and entered the unmarked office. Now what?
Guess where he is now, Eckler said. I don't want to guess, Marjorie growled. He's parked across the street from your office. What do you want me to do?
I don't know. Just stay on him.
Marjorie disconnected the call. Now what?
In the 2 years Sarah Johnson had been writing her pointless blog, she'd named Leonard Curtis and numerous lawmakers, lawyers, and judges, but Johnson had never, ever mentioned her or Bill. So Johnson, as near as Marjorie could tell, never had any idea that she and Bill worked for Curtis. But somehow this son of a bitch, DeMarco, had found them in less than a week. DeMarco locating them obviously had something to do with his trip to Great Falls, because right after he returned from there, he started following Bill. Marjorie tried to think who DeMarco might have talked to in northwestern Montana, but no one immediately came to mind. There were at least a dozen folks in the Great Falls area that they'd done business with over the years. In order to identify who DeMarco might have talked to, Marjorie would probably have to go through Johnson's fucking blog again. Hundreds and hundreds of pages, probably a million goddamn words. Marjorie had always thought that Johnson's blog should have been used by the CIA to torture terrorists. She could envision some guy in a cell down there at Guantanamo Bay, strapped naked to a chair, dogs snapping in his nuts, a bag over his head, as Johnson's blog was read to him until he either confessed or went insane. So what should she do? The right answer was probably do nothing. If Johnson hadn't been able to build a legal case against Curtis in 2 years, then DeMarco probably couldn't either. On the other hand, DeMarco was a guy who had some political clout. What if he got some law enforcement agency, or maybe the North Dakota Attorney General, to start investigating her and Bill to see if they could be linked to any of the nonsense in Johnson's blog? They probably wouldn't be able to prove that she and Bill had done anything illegal, but if the cops were watching them and prying into their business, then that could render them virtually useless insofar as working for Curtis, and then Curtis would fire them. She needed to find out what DeMarco was up to, and she was beginning to believe that having Heckler follow him wasn't going to tell her what she needed to know. Then she thought, why not just ask the damn guy what he was doing? What did she have to lose? She told Bill, who was acting more like his old self this morning, alert and cheerful and not hungover, that DeMarco had followed him from his home to their office this morning. She thought for a minute that Bill might throw up.
Do you think he knows what we did about, you know?
Bill was asking if DeMarco knew that they'd hired Murdoch to kill Sarah Johnson, but he was afraid to say the words out loud.
Bill, if he knew anything, the cops would be parked across the street, not him. So get a grip on yourself.
Marjorie stood up. I'm going to ask him what the hell he thinks he's doing, following you around.
Marge, I don't think that's a good idea.
Marjorie didn't care what he thought. She said, I'm going to invite him into the office and talk to him, and I want you to keep your mouth shut. Your head still isn't screwed on right.
DeMarco saw a woman come out of the office that Logan had entered. She was about 5'4", busty, and had short brown hair. She was cute. She crossed the strip mall parking lot. She had a bouncy, energetic way of walking, stopped at the curb, looked both ways before she crossed the street and came toward his car. She made a motion for him to roll down the window. She smiled at him.
"Hi. Why don't you come on into the office so we can talk, Mr. DeMarco? There's no point in you sitting out here in your car, or following my partner around."
How the hell did she know who he was? And how did she know that he'd been following Logan? But instead of asking those questions, he said,
"Sure, let's talk."
He was thinking, this could actually be a good thing, as he hadn't been sure what to do next. Plus, it would give him a chance to see how hard it would be to break into the office if he decided to do that. He followed her into her office. Bill Logan was sitting behind a desk, and he raised his hand in a little hello gesture when he saw DeMarco. Logan was trying to act as if he didn't have a worry in the world, but DeMarco could see the tension in his eyes. His partner, however, seemed genuinely relaxed. He noticed that the office was a lot like his office in the Capitol. Cheap furniture, not much of it, and nothing fancy. The file cabinets they had were identical to the one in his office. Four drawers, constructed of sheet metal, and the same shade of gunmetal gray. When DeMarco first went to work for Mahoney, he apprenticed under a guy named Jake, an ex-Boston cop who used to do for Mahoney what DeMarco now did. Jake died of a well-deserved heart attack about 6 months after DeMarco was hired. One day, DeMarco discovered that the file cabinet in their shared office contained nothing but a bottle of Maker's Mark and phone directories. When he asked why there wasn't anything in it, Jake's response was, "They can't subpoena air." DeMarco was willing to bet that the file cabinets in Logan and Dawkins' office were similar. There'd be nothing in them that would cause them a problem if the cops obtained a warrant to examine their contents. DeMarco wondered how much else he might have in common with Logan and Dawkins.
"Would you like a cup of coffee, Mr. DeMarco?"
Dawkins asked.
"Sure,"
DeMarco said. Dawkins poured him a cup and said, "Well, you already know Bill, and I'm assuming you know who I am as well. I'm Marjorie, and would you mind if I called you Joe?"
"Joe would be fine," DeMarco said.
"So, Joe, what's going on?"
"How do you know who I am?" DeMarco asked.
Marjorie smiled. She had a great smile.
"Joe, as the sports guys say, you're in our ballpark. We're the home team. We have the home field advantage."
DeMarco nodded. "Okay, I'll tell you what's going on. There's a guy named Doug Thorpe over in Montana. He's a fly fishing guide. He also served with John Mahoney in Vietnam and saved Mahoney's life a couple of times. I assume you know the John Mahoney I'm talking about."
"Yeah, but so what?"
Marjorie said. "Doug Thorpe is, or was, Sarah Johnson's grandfather. He called Mahoney last week and said that somebody had assaulted Sarah and made death threats against her because she was accusing Leonard Curtis, your boss, of bribing politicians."
"What makes you think we work for Leonard Curtis?"
Marjorie said. DeMarco laughed. "I can tell you I didn't find out from reading your website. What a pile of bullshit that is. So I had someone take a peek at your tax returns and found out that Curtis is the guy who pays your salaries."
"What authority do you have to look at our returns?"
Logan said, and Marjorie whipped her head around to face Logan and said,
"Bill."
And to DeMarco, that sounded like, "Bill, keep your mouth shut." DeMarco didn't answer Logan's question. Instead, he said, "Anyway, Mahoney sent me out here to find out what was going on, and the only reason he did was because Thorpe's his friend. Then Sarah was killed, which was the stupidest thing you people could have done."
"Hey, you watch your mouth," Marjorie said. "We didn't have anything to do with that poor girl's death. We knew about all the wild accusations she'd made against Mr. Curtis, of course, and he sued her because she was saying things about him that were untrue. A couple other people sued her as well. But that's all Mr. Curtis did, and nobody who works for Curtis, including me or Bill, made any death threats, and we sure as hell didn't kill her."
Before DeMarco could speak, she lowered her voice and said in a calmer tone, "Joe, Bill and I are political consultants. We keep our eye on state politics. We advise Mr. Curtis about pending legislation. We try to convince politicians to support his businesses, and we support politicians who feel the same way we do about certain issues. And that's it. That's all we do. We don't go around killing people. We talk to people." As if she hadn't spoken, DeMarco said, "The reason why killing Sarah was so dumb was because she couldn't prove anything. She had no evidence that any crimes had been committed. She couldn't get anybody with a badge to listen to her. But now things have changed, drastically. Right now, thanks to Mahoney, I have my very own FBI agent looking into Sarah's murder. In other words, I have a pit bull with a badge and a gun. And Mahoney is going to call up the governor of Montana, who's a Democrat, and tell him to get his attorney general to take a look at what Curtis has been doing. Unfortunately for Mahoney, that is, the governors of North and South Dakota are currently Republicans, but all three states have U.S. senators who are Democrats, and Mahoney's going to talk to these senators and tell them to get engaged. And in the end, because of all the pressure being brought to bear on the local cops and the FBI, they're going to break someone.
What the hell does that mean?
Logan said. With Sarah Johnson, DeMarco said, you had a young woman with no professional credentials, who hadn't even graduated from college, and who couldn't get anyone to take her seriously. But now it's a whole different ballgame. The FBI is now pouring over Sarah's blog like it's the fucking Warren Report. They're going to start looking at people's finances and phone calls and emails because, unlike Sarah, they have the power to get subpoenas and search warrants. Eventually, they'll find somebody who's committed a crime, and they'll break that person, and he'll point the finger at you two to keep from going to jail. Then guess what's going to happen next? Neither Bill nor Marjorie guessed. Logan just sat there looking scared. Dawkins had a little smile on her face, as if she found DeMarco amusing. What's going to happen, DeMarco said, is one of you is going to turn on the other one to keep from going to jail. That's what always happens, because the FBI is a master at this sort of thing. They get one guy to give up the guy he works for, then that guy gives up the guy he works for. That's how they get all the mafia guys. That's how they get the guys who engage in insider trading and bank fraud and shit like that. And that's how they're going to get you. One of you is going to crack and give up the other one, and then that person is going to give up Curtis. Unless Curtis has that person killed first. DeMarco stood up. Let me tell you one other little thing. The FBI and the Justice Department care about the law, and they follow the rules when it comes to obtaining evidence and interrogating folks. Well, I don't give a shit about the law. The only thing I care about is that I liked Sarah, and I like her grandfather, and I'm going to nail you two, and I don't care how I do it. Thanks for the coffee, Marjorie.
Chapter 17
We're fucked, Bill said.
Marge had been sitting there, about to call Heckler to tell him to stick with DeMarco. Now she shot up from her chair like it was spring-loaded. For just an instant, she considered picking up the stapler on her desk and flinging it at Bill's head as hard as she could.
Listen to me, Bill.
She almost said, listen to me, you idiot.
That little speech that DeMarco just made was total bullshit. And the only reason he made it is because he's hoping one of us will panic. DeMarco has nothing, and the FBI will find nothing. The kind of things we do for Curtis are nowhere near as bad as the crap that goes on in D.C. They have more lobbyists in Washington than they have politicians, and they throw millions at those politicians. When was the last time a D.C. lobbyist was arrested? And what the hell have we done? Arranged for some guy to get his septic system fixed without a permit? Big fucking deal. Nobody's going to jail.
Yeah, but he knows who we are.
Shut up and come outside with me.
Can't you wait until we finish talking to have a cigarette? That's not why we're going outside. Once they got outside, Marjorie did light up a Marlboro, however.
We need to be careful about what we say in the office. Thanks to DeMarco, those FBI weasels might try to tap our phones or bug the office.
But they'd have to get a warrant to do that. Marjorie just looked at him for a moment. Then shook her head.
Sometimes I wonder what planet you live on. The FBI will use the Patriot Act or anything else they can think of to get a warrant if John Mahoney is pressuring them. So I don't want you to say anything on the phone or in the office about Sarah Johnson or Murdoch or Curtis or anything else that somebody could consider the least bit illegal. We're going to keep doing what we've always done, but we're going to be as squeaky clean as... Well, as I don't know what, but squeaky clean. Do you understand?
Yeah. But what do we tell Curtis?
I don't know. I have to think about that. But at some point, we need to let him know about DeMarco.
She dropped her cigarette on the ground and crushed it out. It's Curtis's fault we're in this mess.
We never would have done anything about Johnson if he hadn't forced us. But that's water under the bridge. So you get your head on straight. You don't do anything out of the ordinary. You just go about your business. If the FBI tries to talk to you, you don't talk. They can't force you to talk to them. If they drag you in for questioning, you say you want a lawyer. Then you call me. And after that, you keep your mouth shut. Bill went back inside looking uncertain and queasy. Marjorie lit another cigarette. She was smoking way too much lately, and called Heckler. She told him to stick with DeMarco, then asked, "You know anybody who can tell if our phones or our office is bugged?" "Maybe. There's a guy I know in Minneapolis who used to do stuff like that. I mean, he used to bug phones and offices for the cops. He was a contractor, I guess. You want me to call him?" "Yeah, do that." Marjorie knew, however, that their office being bugged wasn't her biggest problem. Even DeMarco and the FBI weren't her biggest problems. The big problems were Bill and Curtis. Bill was a weak link. He was drinking too much, and he was a nervous wreck because he was an accomplice to Johnson's murder and was terrified he might get caught. Curtis was a different story. There wasn't anything weak about him. He might call Murdoch himself if he thought she and Bill had become liabilities. Chapter 18. "Agent, it's DeMarco. I was thinking maybe we could meet for lunch and compare notes."
"Is that right?" Westerberg said. "Does this mean you're going to tell me why you wanted Bill Logan's address?"
"Yeah, sure," DeMarco said, like he was the most reasonable guy in the world. "Well, we may as well meet, because if I keep reading this blog, my eyes are going to start bleeding."
DeMarco met Westerberg at a place called the Blarney Stone Pub on Main Street, about a mile from the Capitol. The Blarney Stone had red brick walls, old hardwood floors, a long, dark bar, and 20 different beers on tap. Behind the bar was a painting of a cheerful-looking bearded Irishman wearing a red beret and toasting the patrons with a frothy pint of Guinness. DeMarco arrived before Westerberg, took a seat at a table near the bar, and she arrived 5 minutes later. As she came toward him, DeMarco couldn't help but appreciate that she had a nice, trim figure and outstanding legs. She was probably a jogger. She also looked tired, and DeMarco suspected she was working hard because she wanted to go home. She was wearing the same clothes she'd been wearing the evening DeMarco first met her, dark suit, white blouse, except the tie-like scarf was absent. She was probably wearing the same clothes because when she flew or drove to Bismarck from Minneapolis, she hadn't been expecting to stay for long. DeMarco ordered a cheeseburger for lunch. Westerberg asked for a chicken salad. As much as DeMarco wanted to sample one of the many beers the Blarney Stone offered, he followed Westerberg's lead and had an iced tea. After the waitress had taken their order, she said to DeMarco, "So, what's going on?" DeMarco told her about Janet Tyler and how Logan convinced her to stop pursuing a lawsuit against Curtis in return for keeping her son out of jail, and that Tyler was the one who gave him Logan's name. He concluded, saying, "Bill Logan and Marjorie Dawkins are Curtis's go-to guys. They're the ones who have been going around bribing people." "Yeah, I figured that might be the case when I found out they were lobbyists and worked for Curtis. But what Tyler told you isn't proof that Logan did anything illegal, or that he conspired in Johnson's death."
"I realize that," DeMarco said. "But I talked to Dawkins and Logan, and I told them that you were going to find some proof."
"You what? God damn it, DeMarco. If by some remote chance we, and by we, I mean the FBI, can actually build a criminal case against these people, you could screw things up by talking to them. I told you before, you are not law enforcement."
Yeah, DeMarco said, then went on to tell her about his conversation with Bill and Marjorie.
He didn't tell her that he'd referred to her as a pit bull with a badge. He concluded by saying that Logan and Dawkins naturally denied being anything more than innocent political consultants, but Logan had looked particularly nervous, like he was about ready to come out of his skin. "So in other words," Westerberg said, "all you did was forewarn them that they're being investigated."
"What have you got?" DeMarco said to change the subject. "Do the Bismarck cops have anything on Sarah's murder?"
"No. There was no incriminating evidence at the crime scene. One thing that was a bit unusual was that the shooter didn't leave any brass behind. I mean,
It's possible he used a .22 revolver, but folks don't usually buy .22 revolvers. And what this means is that whoever killed Sarah had the presence of mind to pick up the shell casings before he left, which is not what you'd expect if the shooter was some hopped-up meth addict. The other thing is, I thought we might be able to find Sarah's phone. What I'm saying is, if a tweaker stole her phone, he would have started using it, or sold it to somebody, and that person would have used it. But we couldn't locate the phone, so whoever stole it disabled or destroyed it, which, again, isn't typical meth head behavior. So this shooting has the earmarks of a professional hit, but there's no evidence leading to the shooter.
Okay, but that's not exactly big news, DeMarco said. I never did think she was a victim of a random home invasion. Did you get anything else?
Yeah, two things. The first is that Logan took a trip to Denver a few days before Sarah was killed.
What made you look at his travel records? DeMarco asked.
I was just checking him out after you gave me his name, looking at credit card records, tax returns, criminal records, whatever I could look at.
So what about this trip to Denver? Why is that significant?
Because in looking at Logan's travel history, he doesn't usually go to Denver. In fact, until last week, the last time he'd been in Denver was 6 years ago. Normally, he flies to Houston, where Curtis has his headquarters, a PR firm in L.A., and Washington, D.C.
Could you figure out what he was doing in Denver?
No. He checked into a hotel, spent one night there, and flew out the next day. His credit card charges were just for normal things like dinner and booze and snacks. If I had to guess, I'd say he went there for a quick meeting.
By any chance, was anybody connected to Curtis killed right after Logan went to Denver the last time?
Not that I could find, Westerberg said.
Huh, DeMarco said.
He sat there for a moment, turning his iced tea glass in his hands.
Can you get a warrant to tap Logan's phones?
Are you crazy? No judge is going to give me a warrant because the man flew to Denver. I have nothing to indicate that Logan has committed a crime. And what good would tapping his phones do anyway?
I'll tell you what good it would do, DeMarco said. I think if you lean on Logan, you'll scare the shit out of him. You handcuff him, drag him into an interrogation room, read him his rights, then you tell him that Janet Tyler is willing to testify against him, and
testify to what? That Logan said he could keep his son from going to jail if she dropped the lawsuit against Curtis.
In other words, she can testify that Logan admitted to her that he could influence her son's prosecutor.
Yeah, but then you start lying. You lie like a son of a bitch. You say that the prosecutor who Logan paid off to make sure Tyler's son didn't go to jail confessed. You say he confessed because you nailed him on some other bullshit, and he gave up Logan for a reduced sentence. You say that you've also got two or three politicians, people named in Sarah's blog, who've admitted that they took bribes from Logan. They admitted this because you're a badass federal agent and scared them.
Before Westerberg could interrupt him, DeMarco continued,
then you hit Logan between the eyes with his Denver trip. You say you know he went to Denver, and he hired somebody to kill Sarah. You say that you're about ready to arrest the killer, who you can prove was in Denver at the same time as Logan. In other words, you lie some more, and say you found evidence at the crime scene or a picture on a surveillance camera. Whatever you can think of. I mean, you're going to need a pretty good script before you interrogate Logan, but I think you can write one, and maybe he'll fall for it.
And you think if I tell him all these lies, he'll confess?
Probably not. His lawyer will tell him to keep his mouth shut. But after you interrogate him and tell him the lies, Logan might panic and call somebody and say something that will incriminate himself or Curtis. So, let me ask again. Do you think there's any way you might be able to get a warrant to tap Logan's phones?
Forget it. No judge will give me one unless I lie to the judge, which I'm not about to do.
Well then, and I mean hypothetically, could you tap his phones without a warrant?
DeMarco, there is no way in hell that I'm going to break the law no matter who you work for.
Okay, be that way, DeMarco said. But I'm curious about something. Didn't you need a warrant to find out that Logan flew to Denver?
Westerberg looked away, and she looked sheepish. She cleared her throat before she said,
there are a lot of databases out there, databases that legally collect information on people who purchase things, like airline tickets. I just happen to know somebody who has access to the right database.
All right, agent. I'm proud of you.
Shut up, DeMarco.
You said you learned two things. The first was Logan's trip to Denver. What was the second?
When Sarah was assaulted by those three men in April,
She called the cops, and I talked to the two cops who responded to the call. They told me that Sarah couldn't positively identify her attackers because they wore ski masks, but she said one of the men had full sleeves.
Full sleeves?
Tattoos covering his arms, from shoulder to wrist. She couldn't see his face, but she could see the tattoos because he was wearing a t-shirt. And his arm was right in her face because he sat on her chest, holding his hand over her mouth so she couldn't scream. The problem is that she couldn't remember anything distinctive about the tattoos. No image of a screaming eagle or a skull and crossbones or anything like that. The other thing was, this same guy was wearing beat-up old cowboy boots and the boots had silver caps on the toes. The image of Sarah being pushed to the ground and three goons in ski masks standing over her and threatening her made DeMarco want to kill somebody. So how are the tattoos and the boots important if Sarah couldn't ID her attackers? Bismarck is in a big city, and this means that the local cops know most of the local assholes. As soon as Sarah said full sleeves and silver-tipped cowboy boots, they thought of a guy named Roy Patterson.
Did they question Patterson?
Of course. Patterson's alibi for the time Sarah was attacked was another asshole named Mark Jenkins. Jenkins and Patterson said they were sitting in Patterson's double-wide watching a ball game when Sarah was attacked. And the cops couldn't break Patterson's alibi, and you can't arrest somebody for having tattoos and cowboy boots. The other thing was their attitude. Patterson and Jenkins both acted smug when the cops questioned them, like they knew they were getting away with something. But you can't arrest anyone for attitude either. At any rate, based totally on cop instinct and a couple of tattooed arms, the Bismarck cops think that Patterson and Jenkins may have been two of the men who attacked Sarah, but they can't do anything about it.
Are there any surveillance cameras you can look at to see if Jenkins and Patterson were running around town during the time they were supposedly watching this ball game? You know, maybe a red light camera that might have taken their picture?
There aren't all that many public surveillance cameras in Bismarck. This isn't London, and the cops here aren't complete idiots. They actually did check out places between Patterson's trailer and the parking lot where Sarah was attacked. You know, a couple convenience stores and bars where these mutts might have stopped for a beer after they did the job. But they couldn't find anybody who saw them, and the surveillance cameras in those places didn't show anything.
But the cops are sure these guys were involved. Westerberg shrugged.
Are they sure? Well, they'd tell you that they're sure, but as Denzel said in that movie, it's not what you know, it's what you can prove.
Yeah, I guess, DeMarco said, as if he agreed with Westerberg, which he didn't.
But rather than argue with her, and maybe tip his hand, he decided to change the subject.
Did you find anything in Sarah's blog you might be able to pursue?
Westerberg laughed. Let me tell you about the last thing I read in Sarah's blog. There was a North Dakota state senator who changed his vote on a bill related to disposal of wastewater from fracking. This got Sarah's attention because the guy had always been on the right side of environmental issues in the past, and his vote was inconsistent with his voting pattern. So Sarah, she was really good, DeMarco. I wish she'd applied for a job at the Bureau. Anyway, Sarah somehow found out that the sewer line from the senator's house got clogged up by tree roots, and the sewer backed up and flooded his basement. Well, the senator's insurance company, being a typical insurance company, refused to pay for the water damage, which amounted to $8,000. Then, lo and behold, this insurance company, who coincidentally provides insurance for a whole shitload of things connected to Leonard Curtis, has a change of heart. Sarah concluded, of course, that somebody paid the senator a visit and said they might be able to get his insurance company to pay his claim if he quit being such a pill about this wastewater legislation. Then this person, who we now suspect was Logan or Dawkins, made a call to the insurance company, telling them that Curtis was going to find somebody else to insure his many homes and businesses, and the insurance company decided to pay the claim. I mean, everything in her damn blog is like that, DeMarco. Like in this case, an insurance company paid off on a claim they probably should have paid in the first place, and a politician simply changed his mind. There's no way to prove the guy was bribed. You remember that congressman in Louisiana we busted with $90,000 in cash in his freezer? Now you can do something with $90,000 in a freezer. You can't do anything with an insurance company that just decides to do the right thing for once.
Westerberg stood up. I gotta go, DeMarco. I have work to do.
She turned to walk away, then turned back to face him. I don't like the situation I'm in right now. I don't like it at all. Mahoney's got his boot on my boss's neck, and my boss won't assign me to another case until I can convince him that there's nothing I can legally do to catch Sarah's killer. The operative word there being legally. and then my boss will have to convince Mahoney, and Mahoney will probably ask you if I've done everything I can. So I want you to know that I'm busting my ass on this case, but at some point you and Mahoney may have to accept the fact that I can't find the evidence needed to convict someone. I also want you to know it really pisses me off that I have to satisfy you that I'm doing my job.
Sorry, Agent, DeMarco said, not sounding sorry at all. By the way, are you ever going to tell me your first name so I don't have to keep calling you Agent? With all this clout you seem to think I have, I can probably find out on my own if you won't tell me.
My name is Bertha, okay? Are you satisfied? And if you ever call me Bertha, I'll shoot you.
So what do your friends call you?
You're not my friend, DeMarco.
Chapter 19. Mark Jenkins and Roy Patterson. Westerberg had finally given him something he could use, and in this case, Denzel was wrong. DeMarco didn't need proof, he just needed to know he was right. The question was he willing to accept the consequences if he failed? It took him about 2 seconds to decide that, yes, he was. 22-year-old Sarah Johnson, a woman with her whole life ahead of her, had been willing to risk her life to get Leonard Curtis, and DeMarco was willing to risk the possibility of going to jail. So he didn't spend much time agonizing over whether he would do it. He spent the time instead thinking about how to do it, and concluded he needed some help and some equipment he didn't have. If he'd been near New York, he could have called up a couple of mafia-connected lowlives, guys who used to work with his father, and paid them to do the job for him. But he was 1,600 miles from New York. He thought about logistics for another minute, then called Doug Thorpe.
Mr. Thorpe, it's Joe DeMarco.
What do you want, DeMarco?
Do you have any guns?
What?
Yeah, of course.
I don't mean rifles or shotguns. Handguns.
Yeah, I got a couple. Why are you asking?
DeMarco told him, and then told him what he planned to do. He concluded by saying,
You understand you could end up in jail if you help me.
I couldn't care less about jail, Thorpe said.
Okay, as long as you understand.
Then he hesitated and asked,
When's Sarah's funeral?
Friday,
Thorpe said. After speaking to Thorpe, DeMarco called Mahoney and told him he needed Roy Patterson's address. He said that Patterson was a tattooed thug who might have a criminal record and that he lived in a double wide, but that's all he knew. DeMarco might have been able to find Patterson's address using the internet and without Mahoney's help, but he didn't feel like spending hours on a computer. And Mahoney had the sort of connections in D.C. that could find the guy if he lived in a cave. After speaking to his boss, DeMarco got into his rental car and drove slowly through the streets of downtown Bismarck, checking his rearview mirror to see if he could spot whoever was following him. When DeMarco met Dawkins and Logan in their office yesterday, it became apparent to him then that they'd been having him followed. If they hadn't had someone tailing him, how else would Dawkins have known that he'd been following Logan? He didn't buy that you're playing in our ballpark crap that Dawkins tried to feed him. The more startling conclusion he came to was that maybe Logan and Dawkins had someone start following him the day he arrived in Bismarck, or more likely, they'd been following Sarah, and when Sarah met with him, he was identified. This also meant that maybe they knew he and Sarah were seeing people like Janet Tyler, trying to get evidence to use against Curtis. DeMarco also remembered Doug Thorpe telling him that Sarah had been concerned that her phone calls were being monitored, something Thorpe had chalked up to paranoia, and a possibility DeMarco had completely ignored. So it was even possible that Dawkins and Logan, in addition to having him followed, had listened in on calls Sarah and DeMarco had made to each other. And what all this meant was that DeMarco felt more convinced, and more guilty than ever, that he could have been the catalyst for Sarah getting killed. After driving for about 15 minutes, DeMarco was pretty sure he was being followed by a man in a gray Honda sedan. He got on the I-94 interstate in the middle lane, and the Honda got in the same lane, staying 2 cars behind him. At the next exit he came to, DeMarco waited until he was almost past the exit, then turned the wheel hard to the right, cutting in front of an 18-wheeler, almost clipping the semi's front bumper, and took the